podcast. KillerKellerOfficial.com.
Killer Keller Podcast Live Show. Step into the live and dangerous world of music and street culture's number one magazine platform, the Killer Keller Podcast Live Show. Special guests alongside performances, news, reviews, profile pieces to a live studio audience. Your monthly live stream is here. Hit Facebook page Killer Keller Official.
THTC, the UK's leading ethical streetwear label. Organically grown and ethically built garments from hemp, organic cotton and other sustainable materials. 2019 is their 20th anniversary year. Join me with THTC as a Killer Keller podcast sponsor celebrating music, social activism, hemp and street culture. THTC, eco-fashion redefined since 1999.
Beatbox created. Killer Keller. We're here to talk about world music and street culture.
Killer Keller Podcast.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're on now. Look who I've got here. It's Killer Keller Podcast coming to you live and direct, Central London, as central as you need to be. All right, subscribe, like, share. Big shout to our people's Graffiti Kings. And yeah, you guessed it. A guaranteed artist that delivers and you can rely and trust upon. There's a man sitting next to me right now. If you're listening, if you're watching, this is Tommy Evans.
How you doing, sir?
How are you?
I'm good. I feel very content and peaceful in my mint tea, so thank you.
You're at peace.
Yeah, you've made it very hospitable and calm.
Yeah, so with all the beautiful,
yeah,
decorative.
I'm feeling it, definitely.
Yeah. I mean, it's not your first time, man.
It's not, I know, I can't feign it. But it's good to be back.
Yeah.
Thank you for having me.
So you did comment on it, on having a homely, welcoming environment.
Yeah, definitely. And it's very personal to you as well. I love how there's all this sort of, paraphernalia from your creative journey. And it spreads that ambiance and vibe. So yeah, man, there's a lot of history here.
There's a lot of history, bro. Like, I mean, at the time you were here was for the live performance.
That's right, yeah.
Show.
Yeah.
And many a dem and many a parties and many a... Yeah. I mean, I think that makes not only a place you live, but to have... It's what you put out there.
Mm,
it's,
completely.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, definitely, definitely.
I think there's a lot
you really get that here, man. And I love your little picky over there, Lemmy Motorhead.
Yeah, I mean, you guys definitely wouldn't have ever seen this, but to my right, to my left, your right, is a picture of Motorhead, because I'm a big Motorhead fan. But that picture is there because it was photographed just down the road.
Wow.
There. Yeah. They used to live down there.
No way.
Mm, they used to live down there.
Right, I didn't know that.
It's a madness. It's a madness.
Deep.
Yeah, it's all deep. That's the music world, isn't it? Like, especially when you're in a city. The DNA of music.
Yeah, definitely. There's a lot of overlapping Venn diagrams. Remember that from maths at school?
Venn diagrams. Cold.
A virtual Venn diagram, so those overlapping concentric circles of proximity and people intersecting and all that sort of stuff. So yes, that whole thing of like 6 degrees of separation. I think in the music game, it's like 1 degree or 2 degrees.
Yeah, yeah. So. And then social media comes in. It's like yeah, 0 degrees. It's like just DM them, man.
Yeah, completely. That, I think from my time in academia, remember, it's called space-time compression.
Elaborate.
Basically, amongst other things, I have a PhD.
Hey, listen, bro, we're gonna get into some business right now, because the lyrics, I mean, you can always, he's waxing lyrical. This isn't a normal day, everyone. This is Tommy. Explain.
Yeah, so
how did you get that?
Well, to quote myself, in my song "Two Senseis with Broken Pen," I got a PhD in linguistics. No metaphors, don't get it twisted. So it's a very rapper sort of thing to say, "Yo, I got a PhD in language." You know what I mean? It's like, I actually do. That was awarded to me about a year and a bit ago. So it was a great journey, to be honest. And for
hold on. So this was recent.
Yeah, I was just working it out in my head. In the past 2 years, I got a PhD, put a book out, and an album. All in the space of a two-year window.
Get the fucking spuds out for that. That's amazing.
Thank you. Wow. I was mad because I was doing the book and the PhD concurrently. So I was writing my thesis. So I'd do like an hour and then I'd switch over to the book.
No, that's no mean feat, bro. That is a lot of...
Yeah.
Whoa. That's time management.
Yeah. I mean, we were sort of alluding to that before we came on camera, like doing what we do, in 2020, you can't just be... an artist, you don't have that. I just want to create. You know, you have to be your own brand manager, your own cinematographer, your own graphic designer, your own agent, your own PR manager, etc. So, for me, I just love language. I love creativity. I love expression. And I see it all as one continuum of creativity. Mm. So when I set myself that goal of doing the PhD, I immersed myself completely in it. And surprisingly, and this did take me by surprise, there's many an overlap between the world of academia and the music industry, believe it or not.
For real, you think?
Yeah, because they're both, you know, their own sort of industries in their own right. So they have their own issues of personalities, politics, privilege, power, etc. So, you know, there's certain rules that govern those domains. And again, certain social networks and cultural capital, and, you know, there's money behind, you know what I mean? It works like that. And ironically, it actually manifested literally. So I did a bunch of research with Cambridge University, actually. Right. My first academic paper was published through Cambridge University. And whilst I was doing work with them, I met a guy who used to be So Solid's A&R. No way. So he worked for Independiente.
Yeah, of course.
And so we clicked because I worked with Martina Topley Bird, who obviously worked with Tricky, sang with Massive Attack on their tours and whatnot. So obviously he knew Martina from his time at Independiente, working with Soul Solid. So we were just sort of going back and forth about, you know, that whole sort of epoch and whatnot.
In what setting did you meet them? Was it in the during the course?
No, that was actually at Cambridge University. So I was studying in London, but then just doing what I do, you sort of, you know, have that network, you make connections and stuff. So I got involved in a research project in Cambridge, and it just so happened that this guy had a background in the music industry.
It comes
like myself,
6 degrees of separation again.
Yeah, completely. Yeah. So it was just deep. But he, you know, he'd gone like on a completely different trajectory and tangent, but you know, there's a lot of transferable skills. And for me, at the end of the day, it's all about communication. So you're trying to express an idea to an audience in a way that is most impactful. So whether it's, a scholastic academic crowd, you have to know how to convey your words, your ideas, your opinions to that demographic. Mm. Just as, you know, when we're performing to a different audience, then, you know, how do we want our message to be most impactful? So there's a lot of similar skill sets that underpin the industries that
which you can transfer. And Ben Bailey-Smith said a very similar thing. Mm. You know, there's a lot of things like in the times that he's been on here a couple of times now, and there's this undertone of, had it not been for his coming up within the music rap scene, some of those disciplines that we were just practicing for fun as kids suddenly get implemented in a whole different way. And you realize that these are actual fundamental set skills of just getting by.
Life skills.
Definitely.
It's funny actually, because we actually worked together on a youth project years ago, so we also have a connection outside of rap and music and stuff.
That's
in terms of
sick.
It was awesome, man. Awesome project, man. Just supporting young people and children from refugee backgrounds. So he's someone who, you know, there's a lot of people that can talk the talk, but he walks the walk in terms of he's done a lot of good for the community behind the scenes.
Those are my favorite friendships, when you meet people that are off, that you meet through music, actually you really like celebrate like developing as friends in
definitely
world.
Man, you have that, you gel outside of the industry sphere and whatnot. But I totally relate to what you're saying. I mean, just as we were alluding to before we came on camera, you know, like as an independent artist, I'm not just making music, I'm handling so many other areas of the output as well. So, you know, I saw in New Year 2020, I was working on a video, editing it, and then also doing the design for a single out as well. So, you know, those skills that I learned in my first degree, humble brag, or not so humble brag. I'm from a family of artists, basically. Yeah. So my first degree was in visual communication, which is a euphemism for graphic design. Mm. So, you know, a lot of those skills, you know, I still use to this day, even though I'm not necessarily traversing the art industry, you know, Saatchi and Saatchi, all that sort of thing. There's so much that you can take and apply wherever you are. So like I said, life skills.
Life skills for real.
It's all positive.
Yeah, yeah. It's all vibes. Yeah. The amount of work that you put in, I'm sure you more than anyone can relate to this because of all the educational like journeys you've taken.
Yeah, yeah.
The work rate on paper is like, oh shit, But over a course, and this is why I think education is fundamental, you develop a tolerance and a thick skin.
Yeah,
The journey works.
Definitely. And do you know what? That's why I call my album Anti-Fragile. So that's what I'm alluding to there, that stoicism.
Stoicism. Yeah. Oh, that's the first time this has been said on a fucking podcast. Come on.
Or grit, to quote Angela Duckworth. So it's that quality of resilience. And I think as you mature and become more comfortable in yourself, you're more adept at handling, you know, these challenges that life throws at you. So definitely things that maybe at the start of my journey in the music industry, I found challenging. Now, it doesn't mean I find it to be hard work. I have to work hard. So when you say it's hard work, this sounds like there's a begrudging element to it.
For real, yeah.
But when you work hard, you accept there is going to be a certain level of exertion, but you face it head on, apply yourself diligently, get the job done and deliver. So we work hard to put our creativity out there.
I love that wordplay you just threw then. And you know,
my craft, you know.
For a minute there, you know what I mean? We were just gassing, but the truth is, for those of you who don't know, like, this guy beside me, I've known him for a long time, Tommy, you know, and, you know, you come up from the ranks of a heritage and still with a high degree of relevance. The lyricism that you play on, I mean, I guess it's coined alternative rap nowadays.
Yeah,
right?
I guess people, I mean, the whole thing with labels is fascinating because I think as artists, we're less fussy about labeling our output.
Even more so nowadays, for real.
Yeah, right? There's a lot more, like, you know, overlap and bricolage, etc. But I think for audiences and media, I can understand the utility in labeling things. So there is a purpose to it. It makes it maybe simpler for people to consume. But yeah, I think in today's climate, what I do would be labeled alternative rap, alternative hip hop. Mm-hmm. And I don't take that as a bad thing. It's, you know, if that's what, as a functionality to it.
There's a great paddock to be like at the moment.
Yeah. I mean, but yeah, for me, it's just, like I said, it's all one continuum of creativity. So whether I'm doing graphic design, you know, producing videos, making music, writing a book, academia, it all intersects, it all overlaps. So for me, it's just a form of expression. I have this energy inside me which I have to get out somehow, some way. So, yeah.
Have you had an IQ test?
I haven't, actually. I don't think I'd score particularly high because I'm not very good at practical things. So, for instance, whilst I found my PhD easy, my driving test... That, however, I found very difficult. I won't say how many attempts it took, but it was more than one.
Well, you know, funny you say that. I mean, I won't say no names. A friend of mine, I was talking to him the other day, and he'd been, like, depressed for ages, and he didn't. Like, he kind of did. It's been a lifelong struggle of his. He's depressed. So, and out of the blue, his doctor was like, have you ever had an IQ test?
Oh, okay, deep.
Right. For real, it's like he surpassed to the point that apparently there is a level in... that is associated with depression of being of over high.
I've heard of this. I think there is some statistics that I've seen somewhere, although I can't recall them immediately to my head, that talks about the prevalence of mental health issues amongst postgraduate researchers, basically PhD candidates, because of the demands of that level of study. So yeah, I can really believe that. It's really deep.
I would imagine there's a Goldilocks zone of, like, just being, you know, the common sense, the high IQ, a good solid high IQ, the athleticism to go.
Yeah,
I would imagine this is like a real Goldilocks area.
Yeah. I'm probably working on the latter one a bit more. Of a
dude, have you? There's also this chess player. I forget his name. It's like young gun chess player, like the Tiger Woods of chess.
Okay,
fuck, I'm gonna get comments now, but I can't remember the name of him. But my Trip, you know, my boy Trip, MC.
Yeah.
He hit me up the other day and he was telling me about this cat and the levels chess from an intellectual point of view. I had no idea that there was like different. Well, I knew there were different moves, but I didn't know there was like over a billion.
Wow, that's crazy. I'm still getting to grips with drafts, you know. chess is a bit beyond me, but
yeah, I mean, but like there's crazy intelligent people out there, and you know, do you think that like a game that's for decades and decades and decades old, you know? I mean, you know, unlocking four chords on a guitar is one thing, but you know, when you're unlocking the mind,
and
I guess that plays in a similar way with lyricism.
Yeah, definitely. For me, it's a mathematical puzzle. So there's a science behind the art, a grit behind the glitz. And when I'm constructing bars, I'm thinking of syllables. How many syllables can I fit into a line? So depending on the tempo, I know, right, I can fit like 10 syllables, or is it 12 or 8? You know? And so that really determines the placement of the words and how you articulate things. So yeah, there's a real science to the art, and I love the intellectual stimulation. For instance, I've been working on a tune for like the past few days, and just literally just playing it over and over and working out the lines. I'd be at the gym, and so I do a lot of multitasking. We're talking about time management. I do a lot of rehearsing of my music in the gym, so I'll be on the pedal bike or lifting weights.
That's a boss idea. That is such a good idea.
Yeah, for me, like, my time is so precious. It really is. Like, I have to, you know, extract the most utility out of every single second of the day. So, you know, I love my two favorite places to be at the studio and the gym. So I think I've yielded more success in the studio, but more visible returns and gains. But
still multitasking badass.
We try. But yeah, you know, I'll be on like the bike or lifting the weights and like, yeah, just like rehearsing the lines over and over, or even writing them, you know. I mean, I'll have my phone writing while I'm on the bike and stuff. So whatever it takes to get, you know, the artistry out there. But yeah, there's a definite mathematical component to music. Are you familiar with the 10,000 hour rule?
Yeah, I get scrutinized for bringing that as like a you know, as a term, as a thing. I mean, because I don't know the back end of it, but I have my theory that I think is correct when I say it.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean?
Yeah, because it discusses chess. So the 10,000 hour rule is a heuristic popularized by Malcolm Gladwell.
That was the one, yeah.
And in his book Outliers, so he presents this thesis in which the premise is that to achieve mastery of a discipline, you have to insert 10,000 hours of practice, which equates to 10 years. But he took the idea from a Danish researcher called Anders Ericsson, who spent about 3 decades on deliberate practice. That's his sort of area of focus. So yeah, Gladwell cites, you know, all these different disciplines in terms of providing evidence for this rule, for this hypothesis. But one of the areas is chess. I think he talks about the Beatles a lot as well. They played live for many years, honing their skills, and they would perform for like 8-9 hours at a time in these clubs in Germany. So it meant by the time they were releasing Sgt. Pepper's and Revolver and those sorts of albums, where they were very experimental,
they were peak,
putting their 10,000 practice hours. So they're seeing like the fruits of the return. Anders Ericsson talks about as well how in families where there are siblings applying themselves in the same discipline, the younger sibling tends to fare well the most because they can benefit from the expertise of their older peers and brothers and sisters. So he talks about Mozart. Mozart, you know, there's this whole sort of mythology about like he was a child prodigy, but it's often neglected his dad was a musician. And his dad, well, not exactly a failed musician, but obviously didn't reach the heights that Mozart did, but obviously sort of lived vicariously through Mozart. But also Mozart had sisters as well, I believe, who are musicians.
Older or younger?
Older, I think. So I think he imbibed a lot of those skills. It's in Anders Ericsson's book, Peaks. I recommend it. I apologize if I'm not quoted it correctly. But the other one, another example he cites, are the Williams sisters, Venus and Serena. So again, they picked up the tennis rackets at a young age, and both were amazing, but the one who achieved like GOAT status is Serena, and she's the younger sister, so she benefited not just from the expertise of her dad coaching her, but from her sister Venus.
That's
as well.
So sick.
Yeah,
right. Now that totally answers so many of my questions. Here's the thing though, because all that being said, these are a handful of anomalies, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Like Mozart, the Beatles, the Williams sisters.
Yeah, yeah.
These are actually, when you think about it, these, I guess, the equivocal in music is your Ed Sheerans, your Adeles, and your Stormzy's, and your Pharrells. We focus on those things, but also I think what those people have are, there's this sort of, again, this sweet spot where just some planets are aligning to make these wonder humans, and it's just everything is just so naturally positioned, you know. She's the younger sister, the family of, and the collective of. There's so many these variables when they suddenly fall in line.
Yeah.
it's, you know, but we do hang on to these hand few, you know, these the chosen few of people,
the outliers, I guess you could say.
When the what's faced in front of us is actually like, you know, a rocky road of a lot of corpses.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And we just got to, as artists, we do see the long road. And,
Completely.
But we do hang on these. We hang on these
it's
chosen
so
few. Don't
easy
we?
To, is it? And it's many. I guess it's intuitive and natural that, you know, you see Jay-Z and Beyonce, and like, they're so the exception to the rule.
Yeah.
But because they're so salient and visible and foregrounded, you can like sort of like focus in, zone in on them. I mean, I've, you know, read some mad stats. I think from PRS it was talking about, I don't know how up to date this information is, but, you know, the average amount of payout for artists is like, you know, like $2,000 or $5,000, you know what I mean, in terms of the majority of their members, and they've got hundreds of thousands of members in terms of royalties. And even, I think today I was looking at, in terms of Spotify streams, like the average amount of Spotify streams that an artist will get in a year is like 5,000 or something. Like, if you look at, you know, if you take all of the people that are uploading music to Spotify. But I think we're naturally drawn, like moths to candles, to those that are burning the most brightest.
Yeah.
And I suppose all you can do is try and apply yourself so you get as close to that sweet spot as you said.
But you're a very malleable it's in delegation. You have your hands in all sorts of things.
Definitely.
When it comes to like having that tunnel vision of thinking that I'm gonna be a music that's gonna be my career, I'm gonna be a star, and you know, Spotify's gonna help aid that. You know what I mean? it ain't the one. You have to be able to, you know, do other things.
Yeah, definitely. Especially in 2020, I mean, like the old models are sort of like very antiquated now. So you know, as we said, you're handling so many other areas aside from the music. In a way, almost becomes the smallest component of what you do. Which, on, you know, one level is maybe a shame, but it's the reality, and you have to be pragmatic about it and think, all right, you just have to do what it takes to get out there. And now, obviously, you know, we'd all like those 5-0 victories, to use a football metaphor.
Mm.
But as I was saying to an artist the other day, a lot of time it might just be getting those functional 1-0 results that win you the league. They're not glamorous, but you just play solid, steady, and in the long term, it pays off.
Playing the long game.
Definitely. But again, I think for maybe younger artists and creatives who have grown up only in a social media age, that imagery is so salient and powerful and alluring that you see the end results and you see peers who are in your same age. You're like, I want to score that person. They're on this amount of followers. They must be getting paid. And necessarily not necessarily privy to what's going on behind the scenes. So you're very enamored by the external when, you know, you really don't know what's going on internally, and you know the hardship that that individual has endured to get to that point. So,
but these endurances, like they're not seen either. It's like they're chosen pictures. They're chosen by design to make you to show opulence, so that they know they don't have any problem. There's no problem behind this curtain. So
everyone's got something they're dealing with,
and it's fed to people, and then people it's like a weird cycle of like kids want to be that, they become that, they copy that, and then there's another one, and then there's another. It just goes round like a conveyor belt, doesn't
it? It's funny. And to have the courage to maybe do something a bit different. I mean, look at what JME did recently in terms of like just releasing his album in physical format. I was like, wow, that takes a lot of courage and conviction in what you do.
That was just, it was so sweet. And it's, I don't think he was on a mission to revive any sort of like hard copy. I just kind of really valued the morals of it.
I thought it was an audacious statement. Hats off. I mean, you know, as he says in song, integrity, that someone who's always been very committed to the craft and whatnot. And I'm going to throw in another one that's very topical. Prince Harry and Meghan Markle, man. Like, obviously, they are taking their step away from the royal family. I mean, it's a very different domain to what we're doing. Although I have met Prince Harry, but that's another story. He was a very, very cool, humble guy, actually.
Was he?
Yeah. Had some really good banter with him.
You know Trev from Big Trev?
Yeah.
Like, he's always hanging around with Prince Harry, right?
Look at that.
Like, don't know, but you get a gauge of a person.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
and I reckon he's a pretty nice fucking dude.
Do you know what? It's interesting because obviously we live in West London and whatnot, so and we bring up the story of Prince Harry and Meghan. Obviously they're taking their, you know, courageous leap away from the royal family.
Yeah.
Like, and I, like 2 days ago, Meghan Markle was, you know, visiting the community. No one, like, no one knows about that in the news, you know what I mean? Mm. But they've both been doing a lot of support for people from the Grenfell community behind the scenes over the years, you know?
Yeah, that's amazing.
So
yeah, it's fucking great.
You know what I mean? Like, yeah. there's that external that people say you genuinely don't know what's going on behind the scenes. But because I live in that locality, mm-hmm. I'm privy to one or two things mm-hmm. anyway. But yeah, I think all you could do is just try and, you know what it is that you want out of life and just apply yourself diligently to get it. And I have this inverse pyramid theory. So you're talking about timing a moment ago. Mm. So the bottom is talent. It should be the top thing, but the bottom thing is talent. Then it's your work ethic. Mm. Then it's your network. Then it's infrastructure. And I think the infrastructure element has evolved because of social media and technology. You know, before there were certain gatekeepers and institutions you had to go through
mm.
to reach an audience, whether it was a publishing house, if you've got a book.
Yeah.
I self-published, right? Or, you know, maybe it's a university institution, or maybe it's a record label. But obviously, a lot of people are doing stuff independently now and whatnot, because you've those barriers, those gatekeepers, that old order sort of been dismantled slowly and surely. And so, yeah, so talent, work ethic, network, infrastructure, but the last one is timing. And that's the only one that's really beyond your control.
Bro, that is like the peak. That is so the tip.
Yeah.
It's like, it is out of your control. It is the biggest piece of the puzzle by anyone's.
Yeah.
You know, you're thugging it out and you're pushing, Do you think that's what keeps people going, you know, for the long game? Is like, I think in the back of our minds we know timing is essential, but yeah, we've got that in abundance, so why don't we just keep on going until we find that timing and it comes together?
I guess we're optimists as well, so you think whatever it is will happen. I mean, we were talking about Grime Gran earlier, like, she's had a moment, she's 80. You know what I mean?
So yeah, dude, it's true.
It's incredible. So it's not how you start the race, it's how you finish it.
For real. I love that. That's such a great example. Yeah. For those of you who don't know, you're out of town, Grime Gran, just check it out online. It's amazing. When did it all begin for you?
Oh, wow. I think a lot of my passion for creativity comes really from my mum. So I grew up in a house surrounded by books and records. Like, my mum has got some legendary stories, man. Like, my mum met Jimi Hendrix.
What?
Yeah, she met Jimi Hendrix. Like, he was performing in Chester. That's where my mum used to live. And her friends were the supporting act. So she went to the concert and they were like, do you want to meet Jimi? And she was like, yeah, yeah. So they took my mum to, like, his caravan that he was in.
Mad.
And, like, yeah, he was basically there in a very clouded room, shall we say, with slightly underdressed ladies doing his hair and nails, just going, yeah. But, yeah, she's got his autograph to this day. And she met the Rolling Stones. She saw Ike and Tina.
Was this, like, going around with the band that was supporting?
I think she was just, like,
super a fan.
Superfan, just went to just bare concerts and stuff. Like,
and it was a time where they weren't as successful. Yeah, could you?
You know what I mean? You can have the access and whatnot. Mm. She saw, like, Ike and Tina Turner in a Roman amphitheater in the south of France. Saw Stevie Wonder when he was little Stevie Wonder. My mum had, like, a signed copy of Shabba Ranks' album and all this sort of stuff. My mum even got me a copy of Ice Cube's death certificate.
What? Signed?
No, not if only. No, but it was from a workmate. But, like,
that shows the commitment to wanting to get you kind of on board with
inducted
the music.
Inducted into the world, and, like, yeah, quite politicized as well, you know.
It certainly was. So, well, actually was one of my favorite albums.
Yeah, yeah, incredible, man. So yeah, you know, it was, and even, like, when she was pregnant with my brother and went to see Bob Marley and the Wailers. Yeah, yeah. So, like, you know, she was deep in all of that. So I've sort of grown up in that environment and stuff. And, yeah, I love literature as well, which is maybe, you know, where I have that passion for the wordplay and music.
Was your mum academic? Was she into literature and things like that?
So my mum's was a teacher. I'm actually seeing her tomorrow. It's her birthday, so I was just on the phone to her earlier, actually.
There you go.
Coming down from Leeds originally.
I would say happy birthday, but by the time she gets this, it's going to be fucking, you know, your birthday going to be a couple of weeks.
Yeah, happy birthday.
Very happy, belated birthday, Miles.
So, yeah, I think, you know, I've I've been very fortunate in that front, in that I've had that head start in life where, you know, I've grown up in an environment where learning and languages, you know, respected and valorized. So even when I was doing my PhD, even like when my book, my mom was the editor on the book.
Did you proofread?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God.
Multiple times,
that,
yeah.
You know what? Those kind of people that can do that and like really... Those are that shit's priceless in my opinion.
Yeah, completely. In academia, we call it a critical friend. So, I mean, literally, she read like my PhD thesis and my book.
OG.
And the thing with the book as well, triple OG.
Triple OG.
The book I've sort of adapted into my album Anti-Fragile, which I released in November last year. And I'm still adapting the book because there's so many, like 24 poems in there. But the architecture of the poems is very much grounded in rap. So, multi-syllable sensibilities.
Oh, my God.
The projects I'm working on at the moment are still adapted. So there's a lot of content that I can repurpose.
Yeah, for real. Are you going to audio?
That's a great question, actually.
You should definitely.
Yeah. It's funny. I was actually considering that.
When does it become an album, though? When does an audio book that's about poems become an album?
Yeah. That's sort of a grey area, isn't it?
I kind of like it.
Yeah, it makes me think of that William Shatner album. What was it called? Discombambulated Man or something.
That's it. That was a landmark. I loved that.
Big up Bill Shatner.
Oh,
gone! Oh gosh,
man.
He's actually got a show quite soon actually in Londinium, so they're showing The Wrath of Khan and then he's got like a Q&A after. So
he's just become this institution of awesome kitsch and cool.
Yeah,
this is mad.
But I rate you because like dude is in his 80s and he's still doing it. I went to see Tony Bennett perform last year at the Royal Albert Hall.
Wow.
And dude, like he was 92, so he was almost 93. So for me, I was like, that longevity that you can be doing what you love over like multiple decades, and you're performing, you've sold it out over two nights, like 5,000 people a night and stuff. But you've got all different age ranges there.
Yeah.
That's beautiful. See, I tell you who I love as well, David Attenborough. Again, someone who just has got that passion for his craft, and I think it's just got better and better with age, and is arguably his most impactful dude.
That's what I'm saying. Like, talking about Lemmy, you know. There seems to be this swing. People, you know, trends come around, and things come in fashion, and you know the amount of people. I mean, Tony Bennett, man. I mean, he must be in his like fourth summer now.
he's incredible.
Kidding. And people, it's amazing when you see people live that long to surpass and go through their next trend. They become the right fit again. Do you feel like with someone like Tony Bennett and David Attenborough that it's not just their longevity is based on the love that they are given? Do you know what I mean?
Definitely.
The energy that people put into them. They love them so much. Definitely. It's a bit like David Jason. People love him so much. David Jason. That's for those who don't know, David Jason is in our towners. But yeah.
But I think, you know, those characters we've described, they've all given out something special to the world as well. So it's a two-way process. If you're giving out that positive energy and that love and, you know, people can see your sincerity, your craft, then, you know, as the stars align, you know, God's plan, then, you know, people do come to you. I think whatever level you're doing at, you know, if you could have longevity and pursue your passion and do it, you know, not just for like 5 minutes or 15 minutes of fame, but you'll do it 5, 10, 15 years. That's an incredible achievement because there's so many people that preceded us who, you know, burnt brightly. And, you know, I was thinking about, what was I looking at earlier on today? I saw a picture of Tupac and who was it? It was Prodigy. Actually, it was from Prodigy's audiobook. And, you know, God bless their souls, man. Both of them. I mean, Tupac was young when he was like 25. But what he crammed into those like 5 or 6 years of productivity is incredible.
Incredible.
But obviously, I mean, it's so tragic, you know, that he passed away at such a young age.
Can you imagine what he'd be now? I
think he'd be so political and just like be that like wiser, older head.
He'd be a problem. I think he'd be a problem.
Oh, yeah. completely. I mean, it's just, I think people often forget how young he and Biggie were. Like, Biggie was like 23 when he was killed. Like,
hold on, 23?
23, yeah.
Oh, my 23, God. Yeah.
That's so young, man. It's so tragic.
Tragic. I mean, oh, mate, that's terrible, isn't it? I mean, these two characters, to even pair them up into an incident that occurred, it's like these are two very, very different things. Like,
yeah. Completely.
People always say the usual shit, like Biggie Tupac and things like that. But it's like, no.
I appreciate both of
them.
It's
hard. You can't even put them in the same thing.
It's funny because it's the same thing when you know, I like to use sports analogies. Say, you know, people in football, Messi, Ronaldo, who's just appreciate both of them for totally. That. And take the lessons from it. Federer versus Nadal. Like, all these guys I find so inspirational in terms of the commitment to craft. Obviously, it's different to what we're doing, but some of the principles are still there in terms of discipline, focus, loving what you do, that professionalism element. So, yeah. In fact, it's funny, actually. I remember reading Nadal's biography, and he was talking about the Wimbledon final in which he played Federer. It was their third final together. It was the first one Nadal won. Mm. And on the morning of that final in 2008, he was there with his coach. He's like, look, I'm injured, man. Like, I don't think I could do this. You know, my legs are aching. I don't want to go out there. And his coach was saying, look, let's just go on the court, practice a little bit, see if it loosens you up and stuff. They did it, and he still wasn't feeling great. But he's like, look, you know, we could either just, like, give up now, but all you've worked for this moment, it'd be a loss. I just go out there and try and enjoy it. And obviously, it's just like an epic battle, and Nadal won in the end.
Yeah, I remember this. Crazy.
Yeah, you know, classic tennis finals. So, I think as artists, because it's such a spiritual experience for us, we have this notion in our head of like we want it to be the perfect moment when we create our art.
Yeah.
But sometimes you don't. I was reading an interview with Celeste. Have you heard her music?
No. Yeah, it's fire.
So she's incredible, man. She lives not too far from here, actually.
She's a singer, rapper.
Yeah, singer. She's from Brighton. And she's just been voted like the sound for 2020 by the BBC and all this sort of stuff. I think she won like a rising star at Brits last year. Man. She is incredible. But I was reading an interview with her today, and she was talking about a song she's got. I think it's Strange, the song. And she was recording it in LA. And at the time, there was a lot of smog and pollution. For some reason, she said like a voice was like mad croaky. So when she went into the studio to record the song, she delivered it in a slightly different way to how she normally would to preserve her vocal chords. But it came out in such a unique way, more like sort of softly spoken, whispery sound. She was like, this actually works. So again, the circumstances weren't correct or right, but she made the most of it and it actually yielded a greater return. Celeste, you have to check her out, man.
She definitely will.
She's something else, man.
It's mad how circumstances govern your whole thing. And I liked what you were saying there about it's the long game, man. It's totally the long 100%, game.
100%.
Like, time is a currency, and
wow, that's a bit of wordplay, bro. like the metaphors,
it's,
yeah.
It's true, though.
Right? Yeah, times, completely.
And when we look at things from a an iPhone point of view, from a social media point of view, and you see things, you know, all the idealisms and like the some cases the envy of like what people are trying to put out and, you know, and promote. Mm. And like, man, like the immediacy of that makes you want to immediately respond. And what are you looking at? What do you want? It's financially fueled. I want to get to that place if it's fucking riches and whatever. You know what I mean? But the truth is money is the real value.
Yeah, definitely, man.
Time is the real
value. Yeah. But money helps as well. And I think on both fronts, so I love Van Gogh, right? And I sort of use him as the model of to do and not to do as an artist. So in terms of his productivity, time, the amount of work he produced in like a 10-year period is insane.
Yeah,
so prolific. But then when it comes to the money element of it, you know, he saw one painting in his lifetime and he was subsidized by his brother Theo, who after Van Gogh basically killed himself age 37. His brother died I think a couple of years later as well.
Oh, so he was like his muse.
Yeah completely. So with Van Gogh, I think, you know, like he's the archetypal starving artist and someone who, you know, in the long term did get the respect and love he deserved, but didn't necessarily get it in his lifetime. That sort of breaks my heart a bit. You know, like,
do you think Tupac had that? Did you think he was constantly fighting against something?
Yeah, and for some people, I think that drives them. They need, you know, like something to counter against. I mean, yeah, he was so prolific in terms of his output. I think there's a line in Blade Runner, which is my favorite film, where Rutger Hauer, God bless his soul, rest in peace, who played the replicant Bae, says, the light that burns twice as bright, that's half as long, isn't Rutger Hauer, it's the guy who's created that plays Tyrell. So for those that aren't familiar with the film, there's these androids, replicants, because they've got superhuman strength, intelligence, they've given like this finite 4-year lifespan.
It's a deep film, man.
Oh, it's incredible.
I'm not going to lie, I've watched it a bunch of times and I'm still... It's not like it's complicated, but it's...
Layered.
It's layered.
There's so many things you can unpick. Have you seen Blade Runner 2049?
I have, and it's the same thing for me.
It's incredible.
These things are like... because I think it's because it's an independent movie. It's like it was allowed to...
Yeah, yeah.
Created its own thing. It's created a whole...
It's so iconic and influential as well, in terms of like the look of that film has shaped... pop culture.
Totally.
Like any like music video you see, it wants to go for that dystopian sci-fi feel. Yeah. Blade Runner basically has owned it too. So
that's so true, man. Yeah. That's so true.
Even the Spice Girls borrowed the aesthetic of it for their song. Was it the Spice Up
Your Life?
There you go.
It's for the 90s babies out there, right? So you know, I like it when pop culture does that.
I do too. I mean, it's that whole sort of recycle. I mean, when I was doing my my A levels, actually, I'm going to take it back now. There's a poet I study called T.S. Eliot.
Oh, I've heard that.
Yeah, and he has a poem called "The Wasteland." And basically, for me, the technique he uses is sampling. So he makes allusions to previous literary masterpieces and references them in his work. And a lot of it is layered and textured, and you might not get it immediately. And his publishers demanded that he produce notes alongside of it because it is so esoteric and, you know, not necessarily easily penetrable. But what he does is essentially what hip-hop musicians did, less so now in 2020 with sampling, but you know, in the 70s, 80s, 90s, you're recycling past creativity and repurposing it. So again, like I say, for me, I just see all these links and nodes of interconnectivity. So yeah, I said to describe my book, I described it as a cross between T.S. Eliot's Wasteland and Jay-Z's Decoded, which might sound a bit haughty. I'm not saying I'm at the level of those two poets, but again, with Jay-Z's Decoded, he had that similar technique of notes describing his verses. So.
Talk to me about the Decoded.
Oh, gosh. I mean, that book for me was a really great blueprint. Mm-hmm. Jay-Z. Anyway, in terms of combining visuals and verbals, so... In the book, Jay-Z breaks down a lot of his classic songs, but just the layout is amazing as well. There's a lot of beautiful illustrations, photography.
Yeah, I've
there.
Got it. It is something, isn't it?
And so that really inspired me when I was doing my book, Medusa War Weaver in the Absence of Magic. So I didn't want it just to be like pages of verse. I spent 5 years writing it, as I said, concurrent with the PhD.
Wow.
And a year doing the artwork. So I worked with two amazing artists. The cover art was done by an illustrator called Azara Amoy, who's also done the artwork for my album, Antifragile. And the interior art, the design was done by a designer called Abby Wright. And we worked very closely on the whole design because I come from that visual background. So, I mean, they were doing the hard work, so to speak, but I'd be constantly getting my feet. Oh, can you use this font? I'm like really fussy
Being
about my fonts.
Nice and tactile.
Yeah. So I really wanted it to be a visual experience as well in terms of the layout. And you know, I extend that philosophy to my music as well. You know, I don't want it just to sound good. You know, I want my art to look good as well. I want my videos to look good, the photos to be solid. So,
and again, that's something that's super important.
Yeah, completely. I mean, I don't think you can really get away with it not being that to that standard. And you know, the early UK hip-hop days where you put out a vinyl, just like slap a sticker on it and stuff.
Yeah,
not now. I was studying something the other day just about Spotify in terms of selections of artists for playlists, and there has to, even not just in terms of sound quality but the visual quality of the art as well, meeting that sort of professional level. So
I think with Tommy Evans, I feel like your audience, I think they know you, and I believe and I've always thought this, there is a bit of Tommy Evans in your audience. You know what I'm saying? I feel like...
That's really interesting.
I feel like you as a character...
Yeah, yeah.
It's like they... There's a demographic of Tommy Evans's. Do you get what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah. What's that saying? Your vibe attracts your tribe. So
that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, definitely. I think what you put out, you know, you're going to draw that energy back. Mm. It's funny because I remember... going to see Silly Breaks. Have you had Silly Breaks?
I've heard of it. No, I've not heard of it, but I know that, yeah.
Silly's amazing. I've done a little something with him for a future project. Anyway,
nice.
Yeah, I mean, he's an amazing spoken word artist.
That's him. Yeah, bro. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
He's worked with Kasabian.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. A whole there bunch you go. Of things.
Super, super. But he's a lovely guy. And I remember he was performing, I can't remember the venue, but Shay D had put him on. Shay, another individual, amazing work.
Old tight Shay D.
Yeah, completely. And so inspirational. And she was saying, Silly's fans are so nice. So she was talking about promoting the event and she was handing out flyers outside concerts and shows and stuff. But, I'll cover it. I was like, he's a very nice guy himself, you know what I mean? So I can see why. So that, you know, observation you're making. I mean, at the end of the day, I've always tried to be true to myself. I can't pretend to be something I'm not. And I was having this conversation with Fusion, actually, outside the chip shop. And he was talking about my Turbulent Times album, the one with the serial cover, and just sort of how playful and jokey it was.
Yeah, I remember that.
We had fun with it. And you know, I said, well, all I can do is really be me and stuff. And he's like, look, don't belittle that, because there's a lot of people in this industry who pretend to be something they're not. Mm. And I was like, yeah, it's a good point. But for me, it's just so intuitive just to be myself.
Yeah.
And I think as you mature, you get more comfortable and confident.
I was about to say that.
In who you are. Yeah. You know, I've always been like a bit of a geek and a, you know, a guy that likes literature. And I probably downplayed it a little bit when I was younger.
Shall I tell you why? It's because people have got egos and they don't like it when they're being bettered.
Yeah, definitely.
I think you're dealing with a small kind of pond.
Yeah.
At the time.
Yeah, definitely. But I think as well, rap and hip-hop has evolved and has become a bit more open-minded and inclusive on that front in terms of allowing different personalities to be foregrounded and come to the forefront. Mm. Don't get me wrong, there has to be space for the hyper-masculine element as well. Mm. And yeah, I will consume that in equal dosages, you know. But I think, in 2020, it's definitely a lot more open in terms of being yourself.
Yeah. And it creates a good response.
Yeah, definitely. You know, there's a niche for everyone, and it means, you know, you can find yourself, be who you are, be honest, be authentic, be your best self, and other people will be drawn to that. So,
I went to this was actually a highlight of my year. Mm. I went to a Gary Numan concert.
No way!
Real?
Wow! Right.
And dude, true to what you just said there, like. His audience were like the nicest, intellectual, slightly Eddie-ish.
Yeah, yeah.
But super duper, like, they were tribal.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They were like that. Mm. They are Numan fans.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it was just so nice to see the whole of the Roundhouse completely lock off.
Wow.
Just his tribe. Yeah, and And I tell you, no shit, man, like, when you think about his peers... His contemporaries, well, you know, Freddie Mercury, Bowie, people of that, not many of them about, George Michael. I couldn't see Elton John doing what he was doing, because I swear to God, bro, I don't know what yoga classes he's doing, but he was running, like, from a distance, this was like, he was a 21-year-old.
Elton John?
No.
Oh, Gary Newman. Yeah.
He was going crazy.
Wow.
Like, my girlfriend turned around and asked me, like, she couldn't believe it when I told him how old he was.
Yeah, yeah.
It was just mad.
But I think, again, it's that thing, if you love what you're doing, and there is a health side, no doubt, but I was reading some stats today just in terms of, like, five variables that can impact upon lifespan, you know, in terms of alcohol consumption, cigarettes, food, exercise.
Are those impactful?
Yeah, definitely. And he was saying there was this, like, 20-year longitudinal study that was conducted, and it was saying that... the impact it can add, like abstention from certain things or regulation, shall we say, in women, 10 years of life.
For
men,
real?
7 years, yeah. And not just length, but quality of life as well, in terms of, you know, less illness. And if you do get ill, quicker recovery time, etc. So yeah, it's just deep, man. Like, and I think as you mature, you come to cherish health so much more. Like, it's something you take for granted a lot when you're younger.
Well, you see people that you're people you aspire to, you know, the people that you think are immortal. Then they start. You start seeing them falter at a reasonably early age.
Definitely. You know definitely. I mean? Do you know what? It's something I consider a lot. And again, something as I mature, just in terms of people's mental health in this industry. How people stay intact. And it's no wonder there's such a high rate of artists who, you know, indulge in certain vices, because the pressures that you face and that scrutiny that's put upon your life and the ownership over your life that certain audiences feel they're entitled to.
Totally.
It's crazy, man. Yeah. I don't blame, or, you know, I can understand why certain creatives will resort to certain substances to medicate the pain away, the, you know, the fear, the anxiety. So to get through it and to be, you know, like we're saying, you know, to be Tony Bennett or David Attenborough or Gary Newman, to be doing what you love and you've done it for decades and you're still healthy, you know, you're still intact.
Crazy, crazy.
That's something to aspire to. And I think when you're younger, you just see, you know, whoever's like the, you know, the person at the moment.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it's like, can you be that person in 5, 10, 20, 30 years?
Well, yeah, longevity and really it does come down to health.
Yeah, you so know what much, I mean? So much. Which is why I've got honey in my tea and not sugar.
Yeah, and that's
and it's mint tea, not caffeine.
Are you a New Year's resolution kind of guy in that respect? You know, I'm not gonna like do this.
No, not really. I just try and be consistent. I mean, I have many flaws as a human being, but I think one of my strengths is I'm a very consistent person. I'm a very disciplined person. I think I owe a lot of that to my mum. Like, she instilled those habits in me from young.
That's cold, yeah.
So, you know, those working habits that I learned as a child, as a teen, you know, I apply to this day. So, yeah, it's not necessarily a case of, like, it's 2020 now. Now I'll try and just continue doing what I was doing, but just, you know, up it more, you know, incremental gains, aggregate. So,
no, I get it.
But again, for other people, that method was. It's funny because I have a friend who's a poet, JJ Bowler, writer as well. You get what you say,
yeah.
And he was putting up a tweet, and he was talking about you know, different people's working methodologies and how some people, you know, will leave it till late before the deadline to, you know, complete the work, but somehow they thrive off that stress. And I was like, not to belittle it, because I know that works for so many people, but I cannot compute why you would do that to yourself. Like, I've never been in that situation in my life. I just like to do a little bit on a daily basis.
Explain that again. So what's it saying?
So, you know, I mean, it could be like a university deadline. You've got an album to hand in or a photo shoot to do or something, but you've left it late. Some people thrive off the stress, the energy, the pressure. Like, it forces their hand. Like, right, I've only got 4 hours to do this. Right,
yeah,
bang it out, whatever it is.
I mean, there is a bit of that in me where I'm like, there's something that gears me. You know, if someone said, "Oh, you got a month to do that," I wouldn't be jumping in it at the start of the first. But that whole idea of, like you say, leaving it to the 11th hour, just because it feels good. That's just fucked.
Yeah. Do you know what it is? I've realized, for me, I feel that sense that people feel at the 11th hour, I feel that every day. Not in a negative way in terms of like, I feel stressed. It's just like that sense of urgency and immediacy. It's like, for me, I'm always looking for it. So if there's a 5-minute window and I can do something that's going to
within it,
bring me nearer to my long-term goals, I will do it.
Dude, I'm exactly the fucking same. I was worried there for a second when you were talking about the angst of, like, leaving things to the last minute. Yeah. Now when you've said that, I'm like, yo, that's just, you know, in my head, I'm thinking to myself, well, what else am I going to do anyway? Mm-hmm. Like, I've got to be working. What
But it's your passion, isn't it? So, and when it's your passion, in a way, it ceases to feel like arduous. What you have, as I said earlier, you work hard, but it doesn't feel like hard work.
Yeah.
You're doing what you love, you know? So, yeah, like, it's, for me, seen in 2020, like, on my Mac, like, designing a video, designing a cover, like, for me, it's like, yeah, this is getting me nearer to my goal. I'd much rather be doing this than anything else, to be honest.
And this is the thing, like, I mean, I'm harking to maybe some, like, Atomic Habits kind of thing, but, like, I'm a man of, like, goals. Like, I like to have goals. And there was a time where I would hit those goals, and then all of a sudden it would just be like, all of a sudden the wheels would start getting a little bit.
What do you do next? I've read of a similar phenomenon amongst Olympic athletes.
Really?
Yeah, it's very common, actually. There's some research done on it. how there's this prevalence of athletes winning gold medals at the Olympics and then experiencing depression because they've spent their whole life, 5-10 years building to this moment.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's like, what do I do now? Where do I go?
So now you can understand, well, there is a great snapshot of like where the logical decision would be, well, I've got nothing to live for now. So,
Pull
the trigger.
Yeah, completely. I did a tour a few years ago with like an American comedian, actually. So it was, a multidisciplinary tour, people with different. he's an experienced comedian and whatnot. But also, he ran a business on the side in terms of supporting professional football players, American football players, in their transition from the NFL to civilian life.
Wow.
Because again, same thing, he'd found that there's a lot of incidences of mental health, substance abuse, even suicide. Mm-hmm. So it helped them to become financially literate because obviously they're dealing with huge amounts of money. So it's schooling them, right? How do we invest that so that you're prepared when your finite career as an athlete does come to an end, 10, 15 years, mm-hmm. that you're ready for the next step. Another sign I'm talking
about. That's incredible.
I was going to say another example of that. I'm acquainted with Andre Harriet, who was in Damage, the R&B group from the early 2000s.
Yeah, of course, yeah. Big up Damage as well. Yeah. Come on, legends, get a romance. Come on.
Legends in the game. He's someone that is doing incredible work in resistance. So in terms of supporting young people, getting them out of gang culture, knife crime. And he went back to education after the band had sort of, I mean, they still perform now, like reunion tours or that sort of, like, legacy artists.
Mm.
He runs his own business now in terms of supporting young people, mentoring, all that side of thing. So just imagine, and I interviewed him once for a project, Afropean, amazing multimedia platform, check him out. But he was just talking about how they wound down the operation of being a pop band and then dealing with the aftermath of that and then finding new careers. So I think one of his compadres in the band is now a professional chef. The chap that's married to Baby Spice. Mm. I forgot his name. Is it Jade?
Jade.
Yeah. Is it Jade Jones? Forgive me if I forget his name, but yeah. So it's just incredible to see what people do after the thing that they're maybe most famous for. There's even a book called No More Worlds to Conquer, actually. I need to read it, which, again.
Wow, bro, there's a book for everything.
I'm a big book geek.
Yeah, no, but this is, because I was just thinking as you were saying, I mean, it sounds like to some people it's a high class problem, the whole idea of like being successful and then what.
Yeah, yeah.
But it sounds a bit dramatic, but do you think that there is a PTSD?
Definitely. I mean, no, I just reflect upon it all the time, man. Like, human beings, we're fragile creatures.
What the fuck?
You know what I mean? And, like, how do people get through life intact? Mm. It's incredible.
It's walls and things that you, and expectations and things that you actually put in your own mind.
Mm.
These aren't things that you're born with, you know what I mean?
Completely.
Like, I mean, the idea of living itself is like a crazy idea.
Space me out for the evening.
You know what I mean? Like, the levels on that. But just like silly things, first world problems. And madness.
Definitely. And I guess all you can do is appreciate the blessings that you've got and just, It's funny because sometimes you can, I think as optimists, you're always looking forward to the future, but also sometimes you can have, if you've achieved certain milestones in life, you might have a tendency to look back to the past. As Kylo Ren says in Star Wars, kill the past. Well, don't kill it, but I remember in October, I was just prepping for my album launch. I was doing some rehearsals with my DJ. He's based in Camden. And I lived in Camden.
DJ?
DJ Treesus.
Sick.
I used to live with him in Camden at sort of like the height of the UK hip hop, Kung Fu sort of era, HFM, all that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So it was very nostalgic for me because I was sort of going back down memory lane, to quote Minnie Riperton, and sort of like rehearsing with him. Like he used to be, because I had a bit of a hiatus from the music game and stuff. So coming back, going to his pad, he's still sort of in the same area, although I upgraded his pad and we were rehearsing. And then I left, took some, went to the West End. I was like, oh gosh, this is all nostalgia. This is the exact route I used to take to go to like Mr. Bongo's or that sort of thing. You know what I mean?
Beautiful thing.
Going past like One Extra, all that sort of thing. So it's bringing back all these memories. And I was going to the West End because I was actually recording at Sony Studios with another producer I'm working with. And on route, I bumped into a Ashley Walters.
Oh mate, this is just like you're just like having sparks throughout your whole mad. Day.
So I was just watching you a few hours ago on Top Boy. you know what I mean? This is so mad. And that whole day I was just like, yeah, it's been really beautiful, like making that, following that trajectory, that route from Camden to the West End and hitting those landmarks and milestones. But I was like, the Empire, I was going to do some recording at Sony. I was like, this is like new experiences I'm creating. So although the past is nice and I have those fond memories, I'm trying to live in the moment.
Dude, you know what I mean? So you were walking through your past.
Yeah.
To get to the new thing.
Yeah, exactly. Making new memories and moments. So yeah, it was a really poignant moment, man.
It's very poetic. That's like some shit, because it's a very warm and cozy place, is nostalgia. It's the nicest, but there's an air risk in what you're
doing. Oh yeah, definitely. And I think as well, making music, and if I was to be slightly brutal, I think what perhaps a more eloquent, intelligent individuals and myself can make the diagnosis. Perhaps one of the shortcomings of the initial UK hip hop sort of musical movement was there was a nostalgic element to it in terms of recreating New York 1994. But it could be argued that, you know, that was the artists, sort of some of their influences. It's what they knew. They were working with the technology had, the limited infrastructure they had at the time, predating social media. So I think
it did feel, but it, right, okay, here comes spice alert, all right. But it did feel, actually, let me rewind.
It was a beautiful epoch, don't get me wrong.
Let me rewind this back a bit so I get my bearings on what I'm going to say, because it wasn't as progressive as the American scene. It never was going to be, because of that's the birthplace. That's what, you know, they're on the cusp of something, you know. Hot 97's playing in the street in New York, you know. And, you know, you hear Beatnuts tune, it's just going to bang.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And, you know, there would just never be anybody comparable at the time, because there was no technology that there is now.
Yeah.
But then comes the likes of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And, right, dare I say it, but if the bar is low enough and your level of attendance surpasses, then that gives you a wider playing field.
That's really interesting.
To do yourself a better... You're working within a... You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah, that's
the limbo bar is low.
Yeah.
And if you're reaching and you're already, you're more advanced, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I'm not saying that anything, but, you know, the cream rises to the top.
Yeah, definitely. And also sometimes it can take time for, audiences to catch up, you know, for the market to acknowledge the genius or to recognize it.
Yeah.
We're talking about Van Gogh, you know, it took a certain amount of years. Even I was reading, I think Herman Melville, who wrote Moby Dick, you know, at the time of writing, after he released that book, he was sort of largely forgotten for a number of years. He sort of fell out of favor and then basically became popular again. I mean, you could cite that for so many like musicians, artists, writers throughout history, you know, it's a common thing, unfortunately. So it doesn't take away from the quality of the work. It's just sometimes audiences aren't ready for it. And I remember in the UK hip hop days, I was always saying we're about 15 years behind America. And I think I look at where, British rap music, I'm not going to use urban because that's a bit of a euphemism, but, you know, British rap music is now. Stormzy's going on Jimmy Fallon next week, isn't it?
That's crazy.
And it's just like, you know, that would be just incomprehensible 5 years ago, never mind 10, 15 years ago. Like,
and that's where my pride kicks in. I'm like, it's like a human ladder ranging from Mike Skinner prior to that Jest, yourself, the Skinny Mans, the drum and basses, the Skibbidys, these components that then inspired like Roll Deep. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, and slowly but surely the organism of UK dance music and just, it's just such an awesome thing.
Ah, it's great. It's great, man. It's just, I'm really, really happy for... to see anyone doing well. I'm someone that loves to see people succeed. And if I can help people on their journey, I will do it. You know what I mean? I'm not one of these people that's like, you know, very guarded and is going to like hold information. Like, I'm going to be the sole custodian. like, share it, man. We grow collectively, you know?
For real.
But yeah, I mean, I think what Stormzy's achieved has been magnificent, man. And yeah, he's a really sweet, humble dude as well.
And
man.
I met him a couple,
he showed me love as well for my artistry a couple of years ago. Like, that's been one of my highlights to get love from him, you know what I mean? And again, just in terms of support for the Grenfell community, him and Adele, you know what I mean? It's great to see.
Adele
is
a silent fucking swinger, man. She's
incredible,
kills
man.
It.
Incredible what she's accomplished.
Some of the real bad boys move in silence, and it's true. It's like, you don't need to be pumping your shit to people.
No, definitely, man. I mean, and she's just so technically accomplished as well.
Scarily so.
Yeah. I will take inspiration from any sort, where I see that excellence, whatever discipline, if it's different, never mind just a different genre of music, like I was citing examples from sport or literature, if I can extract lessons from these individuals that will help me better my own performance and practice, I'll do it. And I think it's just key is having that open mind and, you know, never thinking that you're the complete package. There's always something that you could improve upon, and just stay humble, man. Like, there's always room for growth and development. So,
I love it.
Me too. That's why I do it, man.
Yeah, it's a real tapestry of ideas you come brought to the podcast.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed talking about these things, because I think often when you do interviews, there can be a certain approach that people do, and I, in a way, prefer these more sort of free flowing stream of consciousness where I can just throw in all these ideas that I've built up over the years and frames of references. So these are the conversations I enjoy the most. So thank you for facilitating them.
I was going to go down the cul-de-sac of, so what you got coming up? But I kind of don't want you to tell us for two reasons. One, I just feel like our conversation has been extremely evergreen.
Yeah, it's been organic.
And secondly, I want you to come back.
No, I'm here, bro.
So let's do a second. Can we do a part two?
Yeah, I'd love to.
1000%. Let's do a part two. Yeah. So it's the part one, all right? We're doing part two. We have to.
That'd be an honor and privilege.
And we're just like, hold tight. Let's just see how many times we can do this shit.
Yeah,
because I just feel like these are, you've got so much intel. You know what I mean? So much info. You know, so much.
We try, man. We try.
You know what I mean? And yeah. I think for all of your output, you're fucking built for podcast.
Yeah. I've thought about that a lot. You know, quite a few people have said to me, you should do podcasts. And at the moment, I just don't have the time. But I think inevitably I will have to do it at some point.
But if you come out here, we're not quite out like once a month or something.
Yeah, I'm down
and then
that.
It's easy. You leave it with me to like...
Yeah. Leave the hard work to this guy.
Yeah, I mean, but honestly, thank you so much, possibly. Insightful.
It's been a pleasure, man. I've really enjoyed it.
Really enjoyed it. And hold tight to Leakin as well, man, for holding it down.
Thank you ever so much.
Keeping it moving, man. We got here.
Good stuff. Thank you, bro.
Ladies and gentlemen, you won't be the last time you see him. Tommy Evans inside the place. If you're out in audio world, man, go check his tunes out too. Thank you so much. Killer Care Podcast, don't forget to subscribe. Do not sleep, I repeat. Do not sleep on this repeat. Don't sleep. Go check it out, all right? Stay lucky, people. Peace.
AG Dentistry. In my line of work, not only does what I do with the mouth get reviewed, it's also my instrument. And it's beyond important to me that my teeth get the professional service they deserve. The AG family provide expert dentistry, whether it's NHS or cosmetic. They're the finest in London. Head over to agdentistry.co.uk for more information on treatments and prices. AG Dentistry.